This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings, welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be talking to Avril Seal. And Avril has written a book entitled Monster Hike, a 100-mile inquiry into the Sasquatch mystery. It's available on Anomalous Books. And it's a book I enjoyed reading quite a bit. We don't deal a ton with Bigfoot on this show. It's one of the reasons I like having Strange Familiars as a part of the Where Did the Road Go sort of group, because he leans a little more toward the Bigfoot material. And I've never done a lot of Bigfoot shows. We did one last week with the Crypto Kid, and this week and next week is this Avril Seal interview, because this went about 2 hours. And we talk about his trip, his hike, as well as different theories on what Bigfoot may be. I myself have always been divided on this. I liked, I was really into the whole Bigfoot thing growing up, but at some point I sort of lost interest. I'm not sure exactly why or where along the way. But, and I think there's evidence for this having some paranormal aspects. And Avril has some really interesting ideas on that, although he does believe it is a flesh and blood undiscovered ape. I mean, there's some aspect of this that has to be flesh and blood to some degree. But what that means in the grand scope of things and why we haven't been able to prove its existence are puzzling. But then you have all the cases where, you know, they're seen with UFOs, or they're seen in areas where there's UFO activity at the same time. And that, I almost wonder if there is if whatever the UFO phenomena is mimicking the Bigfoot phenomena, where it's really just we're dealing with two entirely different things. There's a undiscovered ape. And then a phenomena that, because we, the Bigfoot thing is a mystery, it also sort of mimics that the same way it mimics our technology and or technology slightly in the future to us. I don't know. It's all very kind of interesting when you spread it out and take a look at all the different variations of Bigfoot encounters and stuff like that. So Avril and I spent about 2 hours talking Bigfoot, and I really enjoyed this conversation. It's in contrast to last week's conversation with the Crypto Kid, who doesn't think there's much to Bigfoot. Avril is fully convinced that there is. So one of the things I like to provide on this show is alternate viewpoints, and this is a great example of that. So here you go. This is my conversation with Avril Seal, part one. Patrons will get part two immediately, as well as a little extra bit. Avril, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really honored that you asked me to be on.
You have a new book out through Anomalous Books called Monster Hike, 100-mile inquiry into the Sasquatch mystery. And as you've told me, this is kind of a memoir as much as anything else.
Yeah, it really is. This is a book that it's a weird book in a lot of ways. But it's a memoir. It's a personal story. It's my personal journey with this topic. And, so I try to keep it fun, keep it personal and keep it relatable in that way. So it is a memoir.
Yeah. It's very personable to read. I mean, you feel like you're really getting to know you and the way you think about all this stuff and life in general.
Well, thank you.
And although it is, a Bigfoot book, in a sense, I'd say probably 50% of the book has nothing to do with Bigfoot.
That could be right. It was interesting as I wrote it. I started out writing it as a trail memoir. This is a kind of a subgenre that's been pioneered by a lot of people. Bill Bryson's Walk in the Woods, and Cheryl Strayed's Wild, and this is. It's a trail is kind of a natural thing to carry a narrative. It's really the through story of any book. And I didn't really know where it was going. I thought I'm going to write a trail memoir and there'll be this Bigfoot thing that'll come along every now and then. As I wrote it, that topic began to become more and larger percentage of the whole. And so I don't know if it's probably a little more than half and half with the majority being on the Sasquatch topic. But I was worried at first, like, will people that are interested in Bigfoot stay with me for the rest of it, and will people that are interested in it for the hike stay with me through all the Bigfoot, the deep dive through the Bigfoot stuff. But in the end, I just wrote the book I wanted to write, and
which is good.
Didn't worry too much about the audience.
Yeah, and it's definitely interesting on both fronts. I mean, you have tell people why you decided to do this hike.
Well, I was 49 coming up on 49, and I started thinking about a lot of people, I think, when they reach a landmark birthday, be it 50 or 70 or whatever it is, they want to do something to kind of commemorate it and to challenge themselves. You'll probably remember President George H.W. Bush skydiving at the age of 90 or whenever it was.
Right.
It kind of started out as that. And I wanted to do something, to kind of challenge myself and commemorate this half century of life. I think a lot of people do marathons, which is great, and I'm in awe of those people, but that's just running is something that's never had any affinity. I've never had any affinity for. And the other thing that kind of comes up a lot is skydiving, like I just mentioned. And again, that just seemed like it was over too soon. As I say in the book, over too soon, no matter how well or how poorly it goes.
Yeah.
But this was something I could do all of. This hiking business is something I had kind of dipped my toe in before. And I found, to my surprise, there was this trail in East Texas that was 100 miles long. And I kind of did the math in my head based on what I was able. I hadn't done much hiking really before then. I'd just done kind of, I call it Cub Scout level, 5 miles out and back kind of thing.
Right.
But I kind of figured that if I really set my mind to it, this is something I could accomplish. And so it started out really as that, but all the while in the background, I was learning more and more about this area and learning more and more about the subject of Bigfoot, and they were kind of converging on each other. And so as the hike got closer and closer, it became more and more about that. And that said, if I had gone out there and hadn't seen anything or hadn't heard anything remarkable, I probably would have written a little trail memoir and talked about the squirrels and the crows and the yopon and the beauty berry and the other things I saw out there and the history of the area. I mean, some of that would have probably made for an interesting book, but I did see things and I did hear things, and so it changed the whole character and injected a huge amount of drama that would not have been there otherwise.
And what got you, where was the origin of your Bigfoot interest?
Well, you're probably close to my generation, maybe mm-hmm. a little younger, I don't know, but there was a huge swell of Bigfoot, a presence in popular culture in the 70s. Just as, as a high overview, the Patterson-Gimlin film came out, which is the famous film with the creature that turns and looks over her right shoulder. That came out in 1967. That was shot in 1967. And throughout the mid 70s, you saw this steady increase of interest in popular culture. The Bionic Man, the $6 million man, and Andre the Giant, playing Bigfoot to his, mm-hmm. His Bionic Man. And the creature of Boggy Creek, the horror movie / docudrama that came out. So like just about everybody else in my cultural milieu, I was aware of it and just interested. And I was, I'm the kind of person that a lot of people don't understand why I'm interested in things like this. And conversely, I don't understand how people could not be interested in stuff like this. Unless they just, this is true for most people, they just dismiss it out of hand. That's why they're not. It's like you know, somebody might ask me, well, why aren't you more interested in unicorns? You know, it's kind of the same, thing. Well, of course I'm not, you know, interested in unicorns because they don't exist. But, so I always had this sense that, and I don't know if this was because of the Patterson-Gimlin film and something about it ringing true to me, or just the volume of sightings. I mean, I'm interested in all kinds of things like this, unexplained mysteries where people all over the place and over time, over long periods of time, are reporting these things. And as I went along and as I read more and as I, you know, the internet came into its own in the mid 90s and, you know, lo and behold, I started seeing more and more, you know, it really enables research at a whole other level and connectivity with these topics at a whole other level. And the closer I looked at this phenomenon, the more authentic it became and the more interested I got in it. If I had started looking into it and it was just immediately apparent that it was all BS, then I would have wandered off and gone and studied something else. but the closer I started looking at this, the more convinced I was that this was a real creature. And not just one, by the way, but many, many of them, which is, you know, the only way, naturalistically, the only way that they could exist is to have a breeding population and to be sort of a species.
I had never thought of it as just one. Like that very idea never really occurred to me that people would think it was just one.
I think that's at the root of a lot of the skepticism about it, because I remember seeing a clip from a news show. I think it was Fox News show from a couple of years ago, and it was this big revel. You know, they're all sitting around on the couch yucking it up, and they were going to have one of the hosts of Finding Bigfoot on, and the big teaser was, is there more than one Bigfoot? You know, it was like this, like you thought one was crazy. What about more than one? Well, you know, one would be the craziest of all, right?
Yeah.
So I think most people, I have no scientific data to back this up, but I would guess that most people who are not involved in the subject or haven't really looked into it think that we're talking about one. And linguistically, we almost always talk about Bigfoot, singular, and not Bigfoots and Sasquatches. So I make a point in the book, actually. I kind of nerd out at the end of the book and write a little bit about this linguistically. But I always use the plural form, and a lot of people use Sasquatch as a plural. But I think that kind of muddies the water and adds to this notion that when we're talking about Bigfoot or Sasquatch, we're talking about something like Babe the Big Blue Ox, or, you know, Paul Bunyan, or some singular figure of folklore that's on its face sounds ridiculous if you're just thinking of it as one thing walking around all over North America.
Yeah, like I said, it never even occurred to me people would think that way about it.
Yeah, well, I in my experience, they do. I know in the media coverage that I've seen. They do, and people that I just encounter, you know, just my friends and colleagues. That's kind of the first hurdle that you have to get over is, you mean there's more than one? And the next one, after that, the next one is, you mean they're not just in, or you, if they admit that if they go along with you that it's plural, that they're not just in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
That they are, as I say, from Alaska to Florida. And really, you know, if you get right down to it, all over the world, in the temperate zones of the world. I mean, there are names for these things in every other temperate culture, be it in the, you know, hills of India or the Himalayas, of course, Yeti, the Almas of Russia, the Yeren of China. So you can go around, the globe, and these things seem to exist or have existed in the past. In all of these, you know, remote temperate locations, and even kind of Arctic locations, even.
Yeah, true. And your feeling is that this is a undiscovered primate.
Yes, I mean I think so. I think it's if you know, we're primates, zoologically speaking. So there's this question, this deep question that runs throughout Bigfootology of, are they human? Are they ape? Are they a hybrid of the two? You know, there seems to be this spectrum, even in appearance, where, you know, they could, most sightings, and I'll say most sightings, you know, that I have read or have seen are quite consistent. This is something that to me speaks to the authenticity of it. It's not just all over the board, with some of them looking just like monkeys and other of them looking just like humans. There does seem to be some variation, some individuality in them. But you read a lot of accounts from hunters who are looking at them through their scopes, their rifle scopes, and they won't pull the trigger because they say they look too human. They get a glimpse of that face, and they said, I was afraid that I'd be prosecuted for murder if I had shot it. And you know, then it takes three steps and it's out of range, or they can't see it anymore. That's kind of a common theme of a lot of sighting reports, is how very human they look. On the other hand, well, they're covered in hair and they're 8 feet to 10 feet tall and 900 pounds and clearly out of the range for modern humans. And they don't much exhibit any kind of culture that we would associate with humanity either. I mean, there are some claims that people have that they build fire, but I don't believe that. If that's true, it's so anomalous that it's not at all representative. And, you know, there are other little things like, and I refer to some of these in the book, sort of glimpses or glimmers of the beginnings of culture, these stick structures that you might,
yeah,
would be maybe the very beginnings of some kind of primitive architecture. Some people claim that they will braid things. They'll take weeds or horse hair or something like that. Or people have gone out and there are these stories of ranchers who go out to check on their horses first thing in the morning, and the horse's mane will be braided.
Right. That's also a fairy thing too.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that remains a mystery. But so there, if they do have a culture, it's a very primitive culture, by all accounts. And so, you know, I there are people who, if you buy into the Melba Ketchum study, the DNA study, she says that she has sampled, you know, three complete genomes of them, and they were all identical in this regard, in that the mitochondrial DNA, or the female component of the DNA, was 100% modern human, and the male line was this novel primate, a mixture, actually, she says, a mixture of a novel primate and human DNA. So, you know, according to her, they're maybe over half, you know, human, share half of our DNA with us, but then there's a lot that's just kind of weird looking, she says, under the microscope, you know, loops and, you know, things that don't look particularly naturalistic, almost like they've been edited or something. So it's a deep mystery, but you know, they just on the evidence that we can see plainly, if I can use that term, in the way the footprints look, with the toes being migrated into alignment, as opposed to the great apes, where the toe is opposable.
Right.
These accounts of the faces with the hooded nose instead of the ape-like nose, hooded nose being a nose like ours with downward-facing nostrils, the morphology of their hands, pendulous breasts on the females, that sort of thing. All of that kind of speaks to the very close kinship with humans that they must have, if they're not indeed just a hybrid, just a straight up hybrid of humans and some other primate.
Yeah, Melba Ketchum stuff, I've never known exactly what to think of, because there does seem to be some valid criticism of it, but it's also kind of interesting. I mean, I yeah. can I understand, you know, from her viewpoint of saying, well, I tried to get this published and no one would publish it when they found out what it was. I can see that happening.
Sure.
But at the same time, it kind of disqualifies the info when she has to, you know, buy someplace to publish it, you know? So it's,
right.
It's a really hard one there.
It is hard. And it, you know, I am not to the point of dismissing it. One, for one thing, I don't have the kind of deep scientific knowledge that it would take to really assess that
right.
fairly. But I'll give her what I just said is that just morphologically, they are quite human-like, and it wouldn't surprise me, you know, if they were hybrid humans.
Sure.
On the other hand, you know, so I, you know, she was kind of in a no-win situation, I think, and she felt some kind of, I don't know if she was just fed up or if there was some sort of closing window that she felt that she had to go and do that. And then, you know, she's written some fiction about some, you know, straight up fiction mm-hmm. About the subject since then. And in my mind, you know, that kind of muddies the water. That makes it easier for her critics to say, well, she fancies herself a fiction writer and boy, has she written a lot of fiction, you know,
right.
including the study. So, you know, I give her more credence than I think most people do. And I'm not at all ready to say that no, there's no validity in that study. But again, I think as far as, you know, public relations wise, she's made some unforced errors, but time will tell.
True. Now, a lot of the stuff you, when you go through this trail, you refer to, what's his name? I just lost it here. Bob Garrett.
Bob, right.
So tell people a little about who Bob Garrett is.
Well, I don't know a lot about his deep background, but he's a character. He's a Bigfoot researcher that lives on the edge of Sam Houston Forest, I believe in either Montgomery or Conroe. And these are small towns, mid-sized towns actually now, right on the edge of Sam Houston National Forest. And, you know, I became aware of him through YouTube, first of all, from this video that he shot in 2013, known as the Torn Up Camp. And it's about a 20-minute video that shows his footage that he shot walking around in the dark and purportedly having come upon this camp that was absolutely ripped to shreds. A tent that was ripped, you know, brand new tent that was ripped apart, a campfire that was scattered around, you know, with burning logs that had been thrown on top of the tent, trash everywhere, footprints all through the dirt, and so forth. I mean, and it's a, you know, it's a scary piece of a video if you're the kind of person that likes to go out there, especially into this particular forest and go camping. And so, the next time that I was aware of him, he's made a number of, he had a podcast himself for a while. I'm not sure if he still does, but he is a guest, a recurring guest on Sasquatch Chronicles, mm-hmm. which is now probably the most well-known Bigfoot related podcast. Right. It's exclusively Bigfoot. And so he's been on that show, I don't know, about maybe 10 times, and just tells astonishing stories of encounters all through East Texas. Has had the host of that show, who lives in Washington State, come and visit and has gone on expedition in Sam Houston with him. And it just makes a lot of astonishing claims, not only about the presence and the encounters that he's had with Sasquatches in that forest, but the involvement of some government entity in covering it up. And so I didn't know quite what to make of all that. And so I went out there with an open mind, and within 24 hours, I was seeing and hearing things that were aligning perfectly with Bob's outrageous stories that he was telling on these other podcasts. And so that kind of creates one of the through lines of the book is me testing Bob's. I don't know him. I did try to get in touch with him at one point, but he didn't write me back, which is fine because it's you know, I just kind of cold messaged him, and he didn't get back to me. So no harm, no foul. There, he didn't know who I was or anything about me.
Right. Right.
In any event, you know, this, you know, he talks about helicopters flying at treetop level in the area with searchlights, and you know, he believes that that they've got ground sensors out there. And long story short, he believes that either the Forest Service or some other sort of off the books agency is involved in a sort of war of extermination of these things because of their dangerous nature. And you know, that goes against the thinking of a little, you know, anybody who gives us any the whole subject any credence. I think a lot of people have this image of them as this gentle forest giant, always receding from our view, you know. And there's a lot of evidence for that, but there's also a growing body of evidence that they're not so gentle. And if Bob is correct, then it's a conundrum. You know, you've got old farts like me going out there unarmed, alone and unarmed. You've got, you know, Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts going out there camping. You've got retired groups, and you've got ladies groups going out there birding and looking at butterflies. And if it's true that these things are as dangerous as Bob says, then that the chapter where I talk about this is called the Benevolent Conspiracy. Because if there is a conspiracy, I mean, I do believe that it's out of a genuine concern that these things are dangerous as hell. And it's, they're trying to do something about it in a way that, legally they can. And so that if you buy into this theory, then the cover-up kind of becomes part and parcel of the attempt to eliminate them, because once they're above board and once they're recognized by science and mainstream society, then there won't be any way to take them out. You know, they'll be protected. So that's kind of me just kind of reasoning out everything that I saw and heard out there that aligns with that. And I'll say one more thing, which is that I went out there a week ago. I hadn't been out for a year. I did this hike in early November of 2016 and was just kind of busy writing the book and with the duties of fatherhood and all of that, and hadn't been out there since that hike. Well, with the New Year's that just came, I went back out there with my buddy Wade, who I mentioned in the book, who I'd gone out there 2 years ago with. And we went to an area in the Kelly section of the trail, and there's a pond out there, and we came upon a camp. It was 20 degrees the night we decided to go out there and spend the night, which in Houston is really cold, because you know it's humid down there. So 20 degrees, right. You feel every single one of those, the lack of those degrees. We didn't expect anybody to be out there, and we got out there, and there was this RV with a couple of young women who were boondocking across the United States. They'd just come from Roswell not too long ago, and they were heading to Louisiana next, I think. But they were staying by this pond. And we got to talking with them, and I noticed that there was a car parked next to the RV, and one of them had a Bigfoot kind of air freshener thing hanging from the rear, from the rear view mirror. So we got to talking about Bigfoot and so forth. And she knew this, she had known about Bob Garrett too. And she actually told me where the torn up camp was, because I had been trying to figure it out for years and never could quite figure it out. Anyway, she told me where she thought it was, and it wasn't that far from us. It was maybe 5 miles from us. And then there was this other campsite about 150 feet away from where my buddy and I had set up our tent. And they said, yeah, that guy hasn't been there for 3 days. And we went over there before we left the next morning. I went over there with my camera and started shooting. And there's about $60 tent, no car there, flip-flops on a towel, which it had been a long time since it had been flip-flop weather.
Right.
Fishing rods, a kind of a high-end camp stove on the ground outside the tent, and a thermos and a pot with some stew still stuck to the edges. And so, and they had, these girls had been there for 3 days already. They said they hadn't seen the guy. So here we are about to spend the night at this campground. And we've got our very own abandoned camp there. And Bob talks about this all the time. He says, we run across this kind of thing all the time. You know, $300 worth of camping equipment just abandoned, $400 worth of camping equipment just abandoned. And sure enough, you know, we placed all that together. Some guy had gotten the hell out of there and never come back. And that was our, lullaby that night as we tried to go to sleep. And we took our tent and we pulled that tent within 2 feet of the passenger door of my truck. And we were scared. We were straight up scared.
Now, when you did this hike, there were numerous points where you almost turned around because you were so scared of what was going on.
Well, yeah, one in particular, which was night one, unfortunately. And that's the night things were moving around my camp, which, okay, I'm in the forest, right? Things are going to be moving through the forest at night. But I was hearing, I heard a deer kill. Deers give off a pretty distinctive distress call. And I heard two of them, it sounded like, being killed within about 5 minutes of each other, at a distance of probably 500 or 600 yards. I heard, you know, these helicopters coming in at treetop level in kind of a search mode, like slowly coming in. It's not as if they were going from one side of the forest to the other. Again, this is all after dark. And then after the helicopter, gunshots. And then the helicopter again. And so you just, you know, your mind kind of races forward, and I'm trying to put all these things together like a jigsaw puzzle. And it, to me, it sounded like here comes a helicopter. Then it leaves, and you hear gunshots, and the helicopter comes back, and you don't hear gunshots. I mean, that sounds like somebody being dropped off, taking some shots, and then getting picked up again. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know for a fact that that's what happened, but there are things that happened the next day, things that I encountered the next day that made me wonder. You know, I came upon these two guys on the trail who were telling me about this huge pool of blood that they had found behind them, quarter mile or so, and kind of bipedal trackway leading away from it, where it looked like, you know, they were dragging kind of a Quasimodo thing where he was dragging one foot. So again, all of this stuff is just, you know, this Bob Garrett narrative is just firing on all cylinders for me. And I went out there open-minded that, you know, maybe I'll encounter something that confirms all this wild stuff, but maybe I won't. And within 24 hours, I was hearing the helicopters, I was hearing the gunshots, and, you know, the next morning I was getting accounts of, you know, pools of blood and bipedal trackways. So yeah, I was very scared, and I spent the next night in a developed camp, which is all, it's a completely different experience. I mean, it was the beginning of deer season, and so the camp was filling up with hunters, and there was a full-time park host there. And so the first night I was completely isolated, 6 miles away from my vehicle, and completely by myself. And so the second night I did that, but the third night I had decided that if I was going to finish the hike, I wasn't going to be able to stay out there every night because my adrenals wouldn't hold up. I would land in a Huntsville hospital with a nervous breakdown. So my brother was out there in the area. He was kind of being a support. He was a support vehicle for me. And so I spent the next several nights at a Airbnb rental in a nearby town with him. And he would take me each day to the extraction point of the previous day. And then I would do through the next leg of the hike. So I did the whole hike and I did it in sequence. But I wound up staying out there, not the 7 nights that I had planned, but I guess about three or four nights.
Were you ever concerned that because you read all of Bob's stuff and saw his videos, that was somehow influencing you unconsciously?
Well, yeah, I'm aware that that could still be the case. You know, confirmation bias is a very real thing. And I try to keep it, I try to keep an open mind either way, and not just seize upon this stuff because it made for a good story. You know, and it's possible that there still could be, but again, you know, I went out there a week ago and got more confirmation, of his narrative, which was this abandoned camp that nobody knew about except this one other, you know, this one other couple in this RV. So every time I go out there, that overarching narrative is, and by the way, we were signing these young ladies that were staying in this RV. We were kind of standing around laughing about the fact that it's always a Black Hawk helicopter in these stories. And like, well, how do you know that? You know, I couldn't, from my hammock on night one, I could not tell if whether the helicopter that came around me was a Black Hawk or not, or I don't know what a Black Hawk sounds like. And so we were kind of like, yeah, rolling our eyes, whatever. And 3 days later, so we became Facebook friends, and 3 days later she DM'd me and said, yeah, we moved over to Double Lake, which is another campground in that same forest, and we saw 3 Black Hawk helicopters that afternoon flying around that part of the forest. Now, okay, so the Forest Service has Black Hawk helicopters. You know, they probably have completely unremarkable reasons for having those. You know, they have to do search and rescue, you know, fire, aviation.
Right.
That would explain part of it. And there are all sorts of reasons why the Forest Service would have helicopters. But I found it funny that they're Black Hawks. She confirmed it. You saw them in broad daylight three or four different times. You know, flying around that end, the other opposite end of the forest. I, you know, I went out there with an open mind, and I tend to believe, Bob.
Okay. So even before you went on this hike, you had gone out at a couple of, preemptive sort of preparation type of things, and you heard you heard some stuff.
Yeah. 2 years ago, 2 years from this week when we're talking, I went out there with a friend of mine, same guy I went out there with this week. And it was New Year's. It was just after New Year's. I think it was January 4th. And we walked in about 2.5 miles from one edge of the forest, from the western edge of the forest, and pitched camp by a pond. Again, a pond. it was one of these winter nights in the forest where everything is just dead still. And this is key to the story, is that nothing was moving. It was about 35 degrees, and you know, there were no birds moving, no insects, just still. It was like a freeze frame. And it was about 6 a.m. in the morning. It was still dark. Wasn't even first light yet. And he and I, my friend and I, are both in hammocks. And we've got tarps that we've staked down low over our hammock, so we can't see out. But of course we can hear. And I'm awake because I probably need to go to the restroom. But I haven't, it's so cold that I haven't gotten out of my sleeping bag yet. I haven't gotten out of the hammock. And about 75 feet, I would say, on the other side of my friend, I hear this very sharp clack. And then less than a second later, maybe half a second later, I hear this from about a quarter of a mile beyond that first sound. And I just froze because I was deep enough into this topic at that time that I was pretty sure I knew what I was hearing. And these are, if you're not initiated, these are wood knocks. And you see, you know, the guys on the TV shows doing this all the time. They're not knocking on the trunks of trees and getting responses back from the forest. And investigators believe this is one way they communicate. And one way they communicate is vocalization, you know, howling for great distances. But other times they use this knocking system. It's almost like a Morse code that they seem to be using. And there was no, I should have said earlier, but there was no one else out there. We were a good 3 miles, I would say, from the nearest anything, from the nearest other possible campers. And I just froze and was listening for other signs of some, you know, you would think if something was that close to make that first clack that you would hear footfalls moving away at some point. And I never did hear those, but I fell asleep maybe 15 minutes later. And, you know, I think in retrospect, what was happening is that it was before dawn. We were basically blocking them from this pond. They were coming in for water, like almost all nocturnal animals do, whether they're coyotes or deer or whatever, they'll come and drink before sunup. And then after the sun goes down, they'll start their night by drinking again. So this is just a guess, but I think these were two squatches and they were coming in for water at the end of their shift. You know, they kind of do a split shift with us. But we were blocking their way. And so this was one signaling to the other one, hey, humans over here, and the other one acknowledging it, you know, Roger that, Roger those humans, with that double knock back to him. So that freaked me out pretty good, and it made an impression. And so I knew at that point that they were, and well, Soraya, one of the most interesting part is a few months later, I'm online, I'm looking around at these various databases of sighting reports, and I squint at my screen and I see the same exact date that we were out there. And there's a report from the same forest, same county, of a husband and a wife who were both going through the forest separately. They were an hour apart. They both lived, I believe they lived in Bryan, which would be to the west, and they were driving through the forest to their jobs, and they both were going in, as many people do, they go in before the sun is up. And one saw on this bridge over Lake Conroe, one saw this big, upright, hairy figure out walking on the bridge and actually had to drive around it to get over the bridge and go into the passing lane. And, you know, they're looking up at this huge hairy thing. And then an hour later, so that was one was at 5 a.m. At 6 a.m., the other spouse comes through and sees the same thing. And they call each other once the one that saw it at 6 a.m. gets into work, calls his wife and says, hey, honey, did you happen to see anything weird on the way to work this morning? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, I did. And so they talk it out, and they both saw this this huge animal. And that was at exactly the same time. So that was 9 miles to my east, that bridge. And I heard two of them to my west. So now we've got this independent kind of this, not triangulation exactly, but we've got this, these in three independent reports that establish that there are three of these things within a 9 mile diameter, within a 9 mile area or a circle in the westernmost part of this forest. So I found that very interesting, you know, in trying to think, you know, some people will ask me, well, how many do you think there are? And there's just no way of knowing. I mean, some people, like Jeff Meldrum, who's the kind of the top academic that is willing to study the subject, I think he puts the number at somewhere between 4,000 and 6,000 in North America. But who knows? I mean, there's just no way of knowing. Here we have three and within 9 miles, and who knows if, you know, the thing that I think most people assume about them, the people who admit that there might be more than one, they think they're solitary creatures. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think anytime somebody sees one, there's probably two or three or four in the same vicinity. I think they hunt in groups. They communicate with each other constantly. They're strategic in that way. They're teams, these small family groups. They're not huge groups, but they're, you know, again, two, three, and four seems to be, you know, what these accounts imply. And so in this one national forest, it's hard to say, but it would not surprise me if there were 100 in there. And they're not, of course, they're not limited to the national forest too. They go where they want, and they go across farms and through these forested ranches and into subdivisions and suburbs.
Right.
So they're all over the place.
Okay. So as you went on, as you started the hike, what's the first thing that stuck out to you that might be an indication that you're approaching a Bigfoot in any way?
Well, you know, I think the night one was, well, I take that back. There was some weird knocking going on on day one. I had gone through the forest. I had cached all these bags of food that I thought I was going to be retrieving and eating. And I'd gotten on the trail about 3 p.m. And a couple of hours later, I was in this thick spot and I heard this knocking. And it wasn't rhythmic. It was almost like somebody was building something. I expected to turn the corner and come upon some hillbilly building a still or something out there, but I never could see anything. And then I thought, well, maybe it's a woodpecker, because there are a lot of woodpeckers out there,
right?
Even some very rare ones, endangered. And I was, but it, you know, a woodpecker has that kind of that rapid fire,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like that. It was like something. It's kind of had a random quality to it, and it was louder than that. And I never could catch a glimpse of whatever this was. But it kind of reminded me of these nut crushing stations that I had read about, where they find these boulders and all these nuts that have been clearly, crushed by something with hands. And with rocks, you know, big, you know, also kind of like hand-sized rocks around them. So that was one curious thing that I never really resolved. And then we had all that nonsense on night one with the helicopters and the deer being killed silently, the gunshots. And then the following day is when I really felt like I started seeing prints,
mm-hmm.
For the first time. I was heading into that developed campground where I was going to spend night two, and about 2 or 3 miles before I got there, I started seeing these patches in the trail. And these were, not clear. You know, it would not have convinced anybody who didn't already believe. But because I was in that space and I was on the lookout, I started seeing these prints that were kind of triangular, in the basic shape of a barefoot footprint. And so, and most of them were 2 or 3 inches longer than my shoe, but clearly of a sort of barefoot shape. And then there were others mixed in with those that were about half the length of my shoe. But the same shape, the same kind of, triangular shape to them. And they were going with me, and they were going against the path, and some of them were going across the path, you know, from from one wooded section to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so immediately I started thinking, well, maybe these are females traveling with young ones. Because the prints were not enormous, but they were bigger than my foot. And then there are these other ones that were much smaller than my foot, but the same shape. So that's kind of the working theory that I had. And then they stopped a little bit before the campground. And then the next day they started up again. And they went for over 10 miles. And I could write this off to kind of a, you know, some kind of naturalistic explanation like wind or water or squirrels or something like that. But for the fact that they stopped, and they stopped, interestingly, at about the same time I could start hearing Interstate 45, which is a major, it's a highway that runs from Houston to Dallas. So major interstate highway. And you start hearing it at about 45 minutes before you get there. And so these prints just kind of stopped. And then the next day, interestingly, as I pressed on to the east, I got about 45 minutes away from I-45 again, and here they come again. the same prints. And so that made me even more suspicious. And then on day five is when I came across the print that's on the cover of the book, which I call the Magnolia Alpha Male print, because that confirmed to me that if I had been seeing prints, the prints I had been seeing were female and juvenile, because this was clearly a male. And it was 18 inches long by 9 inches wide. And it was of a completely different order of magnitude as far as its quality. I could make out the toes in it. I could make out the impression of the, by all accounts, Sasquatches have flat feet, which makes sense when you consider that, you know, they're supporting the kind of weight that these creatures must have. They don't have all arches, a ball and arch like we do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this sure enough had that. It showed the full impression of that flat foot all the way around. And it was this area, it's difficult to get prints in this area because of all the pine needles and the leaves and whatnot and the sand. It just doesn't take a print like a muddy bank of a river would. So this was about as good as I could have possibly hoped for out there. With the substrate being what it was. So at that point, that was really the best evidence that I came across, and that's why I slapped it on the cover of the book.
Well, let's pause here for a moment and tell people, okay, so the book is called Monster Hike, out on Anomalous Records. Anomalous Books. Where can people get it?
Amazon. There's this place called Amazon.
All right.
And it's also available in Barnes & Noble. And there's a Kindle version and also a Nook version. Okay. And I understand there's also a distributor in the UK for your listeners across the pond.
Okay, cool. And you have a website, a blog.
Right. It's the website's called The Trailhead, and the address is my name, Averill. Averill, Seal, SEALE, .wordpress.com.
All right. And a special thanks to our Patreons who are pledging at the $10 or above level. John Eddy, Chris Elmquist, Patricia Gaiaquinta, Allison Cook, Robert Groom, Christopher Sheehan, Roland Belstedt, Alfred Tuttle, Carla Mahoney, and Gabriel Zero. Thank you very much. All right, so that was part one of my conversation with Averill. Next week will be part two. If you're a Patreon, you got the full interview, so you could just listen all the way through. And we did a little, 10-minute extra with him as well. If you want to become a patron, go to the website, wheredidtheroadgo.com. All right, to take you out tonight, I'm going to send this song out to Adam Sane. I know he likes these guys. This is a band from Ithaca called Spazzare. And that's two Z's, S-P-A-Z-Z-A-R-E. It's a track entitled
in Heaven, and it's actually live at my other show, The Last Exit for the Lost. If you like this, you can find the video of it at thelastexit.org on our performance YouTube channel. They did about 5 songs, so if you like it, you can find it there. They're also on Bandcamp, so you can check them out there. All right. We will see you next time. have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.